So we're very, very pleased to have here for our seminar series on transforming traditions in the sort of early modern period, this late early modern, Richard Williams, who used to be a student here, and then has now gone on to King's College London, where he is doing a PhD in 19th century music and patronage in India. Very, very pleased to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Great. Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's really good to be back. Krishna's Broken Contract, a Bhakti reading of the Afghan invasions in the 18th century. To this day, the 18th century poet Chacha Hit Brindavan Das, is remembered and respected by his sect, the Radhavallabh Sampradaya, for his devotional hymns. Brindavan Das was initiated into the sect in 1738, and lived in Radhakant temple in Vrindavan, the house of his guru, Hitrup Lalji, for almost 20 years. It seems most likely that Brindavan Das was a dedicated devotee, but did not take the vows of ultimate renunciation himself, which the Radhavallabhis typically do not prioritise over and above householder bhakti. In the only known portrait of Brindavan Das, though he is presented with a congregation of bhaktas, he sits to the side and is distinctively represented in a layman's garb. His major contribution was a substantial collection of song texts written in the Braj Bhasha dialect of Old Hindi, dedicated to the community's worship of Radha and Krishna. 2 decades spent contemplating the divine couple came to an abrupt end in 1757, when the Afghan army of Ahmad Shah Abdali was sent into the Jat territories, invaded Mathura and Vrindavan, and slaughtered its inhabitants. In the Ashar month of the Vikrama year 1817, which is June or July 1760, Brindavan Das completed a poem on this massacre, the Harikala Baili, or the Song of Hari's Art. The poet tells us how he himself had witnessed this invasion and had fled initially to Farrukhabad. From there, he joined the other refugees fleeing Braj and eventually found protection with Suraj Mal, the king of Bharatpur. This representation of events marks a striking departure from the poet's standard bhakti repertoire and is unique in its approach. While contemporary historians and urban poets describe the perceived chaos of the period, Brindavan Das's vantage point is distinct, since his comment on the motions of the political sphere is embedded in the bhakti worldview cultivated in Brindavan. As such, his lament is striking because it employs the same conceptual universe as his other devotional works. At the centre of the disaster in Brindavan sits Brindavan's lord, Krishna, and the poem takes the form of a complaint to the god. However, this complaint does not draw on imagery that we might usually associate with betrayal in a bhakti context. Rather than channeling the voice of the spurned gopi, the poet looks instead to the Mahabharata. This in itself is perhaps surprising, given that the Radhavallabhis are thought to generally direct themselves only to those episodes in the life of Krishna that refer immediately to Radha. Although he discusses episodes of Krishna's permitting the destruction of those dearest to him in the epic, Brindavan Das does not follow their example of elaborating a mythological explanation involving curses and oaths to excuse Krishna's behaviour. The effect is to underline the poet's own doubt and uncertainty as he reflects on his immediate history. Rather than projecting the present into the timeless past of the Krishna narrative, this poem draws religious conceptions into contemporary reality. According to Brindavan Das, the bhaktas had put their faith in Krishna and lived in Braj as his servants. He argues that this relationship entailed some form of contractual protection. By failing to protect the bhaktas from the Afghans, Krishna had betrayed them. In this paper, I suggest that Brindavan Das's argument was embedded in its social context, particularly the breakdown of Mughal rule and concurrent structures of authority. The Harikala Baili is therefore a point of access to the conversation between religious voices and historical circumstances, which Frederick Smith calls the dark matter of religion, of religious tradition and its transmission, the support system without which inspiration cannot arise. Brindavan Das's work gives us an insight into the subjectivity of individuals negotiating religious considerations amid failing systems of social patronage and political chaos. So, by way of background, it helps to recall the events of 1757, especially this is what Brindavan Das does himself. The emperor erred in politics. The provinces blundered in their aims. For many days they wailed over their goblets, and Kabul made its onslaught. All the nobles were inebriated with whoring, intoxication, and drinking. Behold them, drowning in the black stream of passion and darkness. Delhi became a cat that saw and feared the biting dog. Already Muhammad Shah had erred, who shall we question now? Babur and Humayun were put to flight, now they have become barren. The grief from this has spread, people should be tried for their deeds. So when Alamgir II became emperor in 1754, his title was no more than a source of legitimizing authority for other powers in northern India. Perhaps it was for this very reason that Vrindavan Das does not refer to him in the poem, or to his predecessor Ahmad Shah, but to Muhammad Shah, who had not ruled for almost a decade. By 1757, Mughal wealth was exhausted, Maratha armies from the south were plundering Delhi, Jat authority in the east was expanding, and Rohilla Afghans had control of large areas to the east and north of the capital. Against this background, Ahmed Shah Abdali launched a series of campaigns into North India, and by the early 1750s he had authority in Lahore, the Punjab and Multan. After the Vizier of Delhi appointed Adina Beg governor of the Punjab and tried to retake Lahore, Ahmed Shah crossed the Indus again in 1756. He drove out Adina Beg and proceeded to Delhi. Such was the impoverished and disorganized state of Mughal affairs that he found the city defenceless. Emperor Alamgir II was deposed, and Ahmed Shah had his name read out in the city's prayers. He then initiated a month-long loot of the city and murder of its inhabitants. He ultimately granted the city back to the emperor, marrying his son to Alamgir's daughter, a match that came with a dowry of the Punjab and Sindh. Ahmed Shah thus establishes authority in the region through symbolic acts, such as the reading of the Kutba, marriage alliances, but most significantly, terror. On the 22nd of February 1757, Abdali continued into the Jat territories to claim tribute from Raja Surajmal, then the wealthiest ruler in Hindustan. Surajmal was strongly resisting Abdali's intimidating presence in North India and had previously rejected his summons. Abdali's response was twofold. First, he raided the fort of Balughar. Now, according to a contemporary Persian text by Ghulam Hashyan Samin, who accompanied Abdali's troops during the invasion, here Abdali left, quote, an extraordinary display. Wherever your glance fell, nothing else was to be perceived but severed heads upon lances, and the number could not be less than the stars in the heavens. From there, Abdali sent two of his officers with 20,000 men to Mathura and Vrindavan. He ordered that the entire territory be put to the sword. According to Shamin's manuscript, booty was declared a free gift to the looter, and this would have been especially popular after the violent plunder in Delhi, when Abdali strictly demanded sole possessions of the spoils and punished any self-interested soldiers. The army was further instructed to bring the heads of infidels to the tent of the chief minister, who would draw up an account and reward them with 5 rupees for every head. As the Afghans approached, the Marathas fled towards Agra, while the Jat Jawahar Singh raised an army of 5,000 to prevent their entry at Chalmuha, 8 miles north of Mathura. After 9 hours of fighting, the Jats were defeated, with 3,000 casualties. The army entered Mathura on the 28th of February, 2 days after Holi, when naturally there would have been an especially large body of pilgrims. An indiscriminate massacre followed, and the city was burned. On the 6th of March, the army continued to Vrindavan. Now, according to this Persian account by Ghulam Hasan Samin, wherever you gazed, you beheld only heaps of the slain. You could only pick your way with difficulty owing to the quantity of bodies lying about and the amount of blood spilt. At one place we saw about 200 children in a heap. Not one of the dead bodies had a head. The stench and fetor and effluvium in the air were such that it was painful to open your mouth or even draw a breath. For a week after the massacre of Mathura, the river Yamuna flowed red. When Samin visited 2 weeks later, it was still yellow. Visiting the huts of the Bairagi and Sannyasi ascetics, he found their decapitated heads tied to the severed heads of cows. Abdali himself arrived in Mathura on the 15th of March, and Vrindavan 4 days later. When he finally returned to Afghanistan, it was with 28,000 animals laden with loot. In his poem, Vrindavan Das looks back at events in this campaign, especially the massacre of significant devotees. Having invested himself fully in the religious life of Vrindavan, he watched the total desecration of the centre of his spiritual universe. Now, returning to verse 117, it is apparent that Vrindavan Das condemns the Mughals and their failed administration, which paved the way for Kabul. He shames the royal house of Delhi as a terrified, retreating and near infertile institution. Within this portrayal, the last line of the Kabita passes judgment. The Mughal government has squandered its responsibilities and should be called to justice. Or, if we follow an alternative translation, this judgment is borne by the people. In either case, the impression is clear. Whether the nobles have escaped punishment, or whether the populace has suffered for them, the events of 1757 are not just a tragedy, but a moral injustice. However, Brindavan Das does not lay all the blame on the human actors. He reasons that, quote, the intelligent do not normally assign blame in one direction. A disharmonious pair was made on both sides, end quote. As the poem continues, the greater portion of blame is repeatedly assigned to Krishna. Here, I believe it is imperative to understand the god as a historical agent within the context of the poem and its author's worldview. Krishna is placed at the centre of contemporary events. The Yavans came twice and harassed the people. During the years 1813 and 1817, it is Hari who played two tricks and took away everyone's pride. Before, you have made your face favourable to the servants. Now I perceive and understand this that the Lord has instructed. In relation to the body, everything is like a dream. Vrindavan's beloved beauty, no one's power is effective. Behold the great wonder, fear has become like a game. So as God, Krishna has stripped everyone of their pride and certainty. He has humiliated the Mughals, shown no protection to his human devotees, and ultimately turned on the Afghan army too. After the massacre in Vrindavan, Abdali's army moved towards Agra, but yielded ultimately to a cholera epidemic and were forced to retreat to Afghanistan. Brindavan Das suggests that Krishna was perhaps responsible for this turn in events too. With the Yavans, the value of priests, cows and sadhus decreases. Having invited them, then your greatness resounded in Braj. You started the fire, and it is you who goes to put it out. You allowed the theft, and you came to keep guard. Brindavan's beloved beauty, the Lord, is clever in both ways. Like the art of the magician, it cannot be seen. This reading is informed by Deepesh Chakrabarti's caveat that academic historiography relies on a model of a, quote, godless, continuous, empty, and homogeneous time that takes the modern historical consciousness for granted. Brindavan Das does not invoke Krishna as a medium of expression, but as a responsible party, subject to certain responsibilities that have been shaped by a historically conditioned morality. These considerations may account for the otherwise unusual stylistic qualities of the poem. Alison Bush's work suggests that when history was projected into literature, considerations of genre and structure were brought to bear. Reading this poem, we might therefore anticipate a protagonist hero, the Nayaka, developed through the heroic mood, virarasa, and virtuous traits that are readily recognisable, coloured perhaps by the praise of a patron. For Braj literature, so much is apparent in the 16th century text, the Ratnabhavani of Keshav Das. Here, the reification of the royal champion, the hero of Rajputana, sacrifices basic historical content and dramatically revises his biography. However, there is no obvious hero or single protagonist in the Harikala Bailey, nor, for that matter, a particular enemy. In their absence, the text is immersed in moral ambiguity and questioning. What is more, the reader and poet alike have to grapple with this ambiguity by themselves. While other texts use the premise of moral confusion for a god to proclaim a great truth to the bemused mortal, here such a sermon is markedly absent. Thus, while Keshav Das places the god Rama in the narrative to discuss the ensuing war, there is no such guidance here in the Harikala Bailey. This is a pointed silence, serving to authentically represent the perceived absence of God when the Afghans entered Braj, but also the despair of the poet as he struggles for an explanation. As such, the Harikala Bailey reflects a literary shift away from earlier frameworks and the development of an idiosyncratic voice. Now, perhaps Brindavan Das does not resolve the invasion in this way simply because he cannot find any resolution. In places he seems to despair. Quote, Brindavan's beloved beauty, I do not trust you anymore. The discerning people know you to be like this. This is a question of trust, bharosa, rather than theological faith. For Brindavan Das, Krishna had a reputation as tender to the bhaktas, and this reputation is now tarnished. In one of the final couplets, Brindavan Das declares in no uncertain terms, you are the infamous master who has let the devotees go. In this there is no doubt, it is known in the world. Krishna is infamous because he is understood to be the store of compassion, yet has not been compassionate at all. Indeed, this concludes a steady attack on Krishna's reputation from the early verses of the work, where Brindavan Das outlines his character as a cowardly betrayer of his loved ones. I'm just going to quote two verses now. Before your birth, the heavenly voice spoke. Increase the sin of that Kamsa through misfortune upon your father. The one who knows all Dharma in the provinces of the earth, You settled him in the forest for 14 years, where he bore much pain. You abandoned the loving people of Brudj in separation. Your heart was not moved even a little, even for such wailing. Vrindavan's beloved beauty, I do not trust you anymore. The discerning people know you to be like this. You are called strong, but in spite of this there is none weaker than you. Out of fear of the enemy you fled, you went and hid in the water. But if you feel differently, then listen to my witness. I saw the Yavin army of death, turned my back, and fled. You did not take up weapons in the Mahabharata, you grovelled in Magadha, and Bhimasena killed Jarasandha in your clever trick. Vrindavan's beloved beauty, if we are defeated by you, then you have ruined your companionship in a moment. So, this characterization underlines Krishna's role as, in the words of Bimal Krishna Matilal, the devious manipulator. For Matilal, the Krishna of the Mahabharata cannot be subjected to a classical form of theodicy, since he does not have the prerequisite omnipotence that would hold him supremely accountable. However, quote, the concept of God must include a reference to morality and justice, and in this respect, as we all know, the character of Krishna comes under serious criticism, end quote. In this vein, Vrindavan Das delivers his criticism at the level of moral obligation and responsibility to the bhaktas. This obligation is couched in terms of contract, and the expectation that the lord of the land will protect his dependents. Both notions are the cultural legacy of Mughal polity. Early in the poem, Vrindavan Das lists Krishna's epithets, only so that he might show these to be false claims. Appreciator of virtues, full of compassion, great discerner of love, tender to his devotees, we always sing of your complex fame. You have fulfilled your promises in every age, and the sacred texts bear witness. The shelter of those who seek refuge, no other was born to take your name. Significantly, Vrindavan Das structures his argument such that sacred texts are brought forward as evidence, Shaki, that Krishna has promised to be the shelter of his devotees, a responsibility that was his alone. This is in effect a methodical outline of a suit against the god. And this promise becomes a recurring theme in the text and is especially pronounced in the concluding verses. Hail, hail, moon of Brudj, Nanda's delight, sophisticate of virtues. For the sake of the bhaktas, protect your fame and honour, O store of virtues. You bound yourself with a promise to always delight the bhaktas of Brudj. I will hold its various beauties and will not go from the land of Brudj. I remember your words, Lord, I entreat you in this way. Saying this, Vrindavan's beloved beauty, now you set in place a calamity for unalterable bhakti, O Hari. From these lines, it seems that the traditional imagery of Krishna, which drew on allusions to the narrative of his time in Brudj, the moon of Brudj here, etc., has now developed into a conceptually formal bond with social responsibilities. On this basis, as Vrindavan Das understands it, the devotees entered into a relationship with Krishna that was coloured with notions of socio-political protection as much as bhakti. As a result, when the devotees are massacred and the survivors forced to flee their homes and negotiate their way through the perils of the countryside towards an alternative refuge, it is apparent that God is a bad landlord. We traipse between villages, your name is becoming defiled. Why did we become servants marked as your household? Vrindavan's beloved beauty, O Hari, your teaching is good. By our birth we have been your servants, and we have been jived forever. Good and bad are both yours, so repair them yourself, so that the shame does not hang from your neck like this. These lines gesture to early modern systems of household management, drawing on larger Mughal ideologies of reciprocal social relationships and loyalty. This style of complaint, though made against the deity, was perhaps informed by the wider context of the 18th century, a state of disrepair in the mechanics basic to the Mughal administration. The poem seems to voice the anxiety felt at ground level amid the decay of the zamindari infrastructure. Alam has suggested that there would have been a general loss of faith in the systems of nobles and officials after the rapid growth of revenue farming, which implied, quote, men motivated by gains, without any checks and supervision to which a government official, albeit theoretically, was subjected. This breakdown in structures of authority and the weakness of sovereignty may have informed Vrindavan Das's frustration with Krishna's apparent neglect of his responsibilities. Malik suggests how the failure of authoritative bodies, quote, to organize unity against anarchic diversity, is the crucial fact of history of this period, and may account for the prevalent restlessness that appeared everywhere in society, now separated from sovereign authority of the state, end quote. In Vrindavandasa's work, this restlessness and sense of anarchy translates into eschatological anxiety, where reliable systems of practice cannot safeguard the devotees. Quote, O G, loving Siam, what prank are you lost in? The great death has come, the Yavans became a tormenting torturer. The wise lost themselves in knowledge, the proud were lost in pride. The mindful were lost in meditation, ascetics in tapas, chanters in recitation. Householders forget themselves in house and work, kings in their rest. All living beings are afraid, the hearts of sadhus tremble. It is important to note that the poem does not attempt to present a specific patron. The text's provenance is stated as Bharatpur and the king, Sujan Singh, is named. However, this does not suggest that Vrindavandas is claiming him as a patron per se. Indeed, the tone of the work suggests the bewilderment and loss of the community, rather than any optimistic, politically charged statement. In this sense, the poet's representation of Krishna and his systematic exploitation of epic material that reveals the god's manipulative personality is counterintuitive to the political exploitation of the Ramayana across the early modern period. Pollock suggests that the Ramayana gestures to a grounded divine order, focused on the royal figure and a fully developed demonic other. By contrast, the Mahabharata lends itself to political disappointment, disenchantment with the world, and a fundamental bifurcation of the hegemonic spiritual and the political, symbolically coded in the bifurcation of the principal characters. While it makes sense for a Krishna Bhakta to discuss Krishna rather than Ram, nonetheless, Vrindavandas selected these specific materials from the Krishna narrative purposively, and the effect is one of discord rather than legitimization of a Hindu ruler. Considering such works as the products of private rather than state patronage, perhaps involving merchants and local service gentry rather than royal courts, may indicate alternative agendas behind poetry to the more overt political paradigms. In the Harikala Baili, the discord of the political environment is expressed in powerful eschatological imagery and horrific accounts of the devotees' deaths. It is already striking that in verse 20, which I've mentioned before, the hearts of sadhus tremble, indicating that even the theoretically unshakable are shaken by the Afghan presence. The text gathers towards a conclusion by depicting the deaths of the renunciates in hagiographical terms, celebrating their resolution in the face of persecution. In a sense, Vrindavandas finds solace in their determination before their terrible fate and applauds their dedication to religion despite the callousness of their deity. Indeed, despite his outrage and grief, Vrindavandas hints early in the text that he has not abandoned his religion after all, and the text is driven by the premise that there is evidence of religion's excellence within the trauma and tragedy. The poem serves as a framework for the victims, giving the murdered devotees a pious self-control and a degree of agency over their deaths that was comforting to the survivors of Vrindavan. As such, the victims of torture, including Krishnadas and the yogin Yadavdas, are described as achieving their spiritual goals through their resolve in the face of torment. Rather than claiming that Krishna embraces the souls of his slain devotees, it is rather the devotees who actively acquire Krishna through their spiritual strength. For example, Krishnadas remains wrapped by the intoxication of the divine couple's emotion. The Yavan came, the creation was shaken, but he was not at all afraid. He increased his very deep resolve on the feet of the delight of Vyas. Nonetheless, the Mlecha tormented him in various ways. His great desire for the dust of Braj remained night and day. He mixed his body with the dust according to his true vow. Vrindavan's beloved, the path of the ways of love is uniquely crooked. He is only like himself, no new simile can be given. Indeed, at least two ascetics, Premdas and Bhagwandas, cut themselves into pieces in order to claim total agency over their deaths and spiritual aspirations. When he heard the Mlecha coming, by his own hand he cut himself vehemently into pieces. What can I say? Vrindavan's beloved beauty, by his will he made his body meet the dust. What can devotees not do? There is great wonder in this. Similarly, there is a reference to a temple priest who died in the defence of his shrine and a merchant who hurried into Vrindavan when he heard about the massacre in order to assist the survivors. The virtuous deeds of the bhaktas are pushed apart from Krishna. Whatever he does must be borne on their heads as his servants, but the wonderful quality in their deaths is their own. The bhaktas sanctify themselves rather than be blessed by an external divine agent. The divine agent himself is a dangerous combination, capricious, but also the orchestrator of the Dark Age. This latter dimension has an immediate bearing on how Vrindavan Das understands the Afghans. The Afghan army is at the centre of the eschatological landscape, but Vrindavan Das does not attempt to demonise the Muslims or claim that this is a religious war. While the army is certainly a barbaric force in the poem, it cannot be characterised in terms of Aziz Ahmed's reading of counter-epic literature, such as the Hindi Rasas. Indeed, the work gestures to Srinivasan's sense of more complicated histories of accommodation between traditions that are now invariably thought of as mutually hostile. Vrindavan Das refers to the Afghans as Mlecha or Yavans, both broadly used generic terms. They are dehumanised, but not in an especially vitriolic fashion. They are an expression of the Dark Age rather than villains proper. This is especially pronounced in a parallel between Shamim's aforementioned Persian account and the poem. So as Shamim followed the Afghan army across Hindustan, he observed from a distance of 8 kos, which, according to your calculations, could be between 12 or 20 miles away. So from this distance, he saw the dust of the horse's hooves rise up into a giant cloud, quote, as if it were a mountain stretching its head to heaven. Now, interestingly, in the Harikala Baili, this same cloud is rendered into a symptom of the final destruction of the world. Fear in every direction, fearlessness has not one place. Even by their thundering, the clouds wound the people. A great terrible wind rained down a haze of dust. Death dances on our heads, spreading out like a mad elephant. Just as the clouds gather at the time of destruction, the flying dust of the hooves of the Mlecha army overcast the heavens. So, the end of the world is ultimately God's prerogative. By drawing contemporary experience into the Hindu imagination, Vrindavan Das denies the Afghans their moral agency. The responsibility is placed with Krishna. Here, then, the Muslim army is an impersonal force, the apocalyptic weapon of the true agent, the Hindu god. The Harikala Baili therefore contributes to our understanding of Hindu-Muslim perspectives in the pre-colonial period. This nuanced text does not appeal to an anti-Muslim idiom, despite Vrindavan Das's first-hand traumatic experience. Rather than defining unitary religious identity markers, the poem reflects how 18th century Hindu writers engaged subtly with a culture and economy shaped by Islamicate influences. The victims are Bhaktas, caught in a localised tragedy. They are not Hindus in any supralocal communal sense. The eulogising of Bhaktas in this poem might be understood as defining or reifying an identity for the Vaishnava community, in line with Talbot's conception of social history as constructing representations of community that emphasise internal features of solidarity. However, the poet does not elaborate this with a longer history of Vrindavan. The devotees are particularised as individuals, drawn together only momentarily. Like Talbot's Telugu text, the Harikala Baili is not characterised by a pejorative anti-Muslim stance. The Mughals are weak politicians, and the Afghans a terrifying force. But neither is demonic. Despite their brutality, Vrindavan Das does not launch an attack on the soldiers themselves. Now, interestingly, this reading of events contrasts with 20th century accounts, including Natwar Singh's representation of Abdali, which is drawn up in contrast to the noble figure of Surajmal. Quote, in the calmest, most dispassionate manner, he ordered the massacre of innocent people. Nothing horrified him. Cruelty came naturally to him. Ironically, Vrindavan Das uses similarly strong terms to describe Krishna, but not the Afghan. Indeed, there is little evidence in the Harikala Baili for Natwar Singh's assertion that this was a full-bloodied religious war conducted in the sacred Braj region. This view was informed by a reading of Shamim's Persian account, which attempts to represent Abdali as a champion of Islam through references to his prayers, asides to his officers, explicitly stating that he is an upholder of Islam, and his instructions for a chronogram to read that I have given Islam peace from the oppression of the infidel. However, these elements read as superficial glosses onto the historical narrative. From his other reported words and actions, Abdali's motivation was hardly religious, while Shamim's encounter with Muslim victims in Mathura suggests that the Afghan army was not in Braj to protect Islam. Abdali did not have imperial aspirations, but sought to procure income and maintain his following among the military forces of Afghanistan, where he had newly consolidated power. It is apparent that the invasion of Braj was seen as an act of terror against Surajmal, who was withholding tribute, rather than against Vaishnavism. Moreover, the Austrian missionary Joseph Tiefenthaler, who had visited the area only a few years before the massacre, describes the wealth that had poured into Mathura and Vrindavan as prosperous families built their mansions on holy soil. This, as well as the exodus of the wealthier portions of Delhi into Jat territories in 1757, increased the financial incentives for an invasion of Braj. Although Brindaban Das is not immediately concerned with the causes of the invasion, he gestures to the decadent weakness of the Mughals and the failed systems of protection, rather than any virulent assertion of Islam, which underlines the subtlety and nuance of his account. After the events of 1757, Brindaban Das was compelled to move according to the demands and challenges of a turbulent political environment. From his remarks and later compositions, Vijayendra Snatak was able to trace Brindaban Das's constant movement between politically safe territories, first Farrukhabad, then Bharatpur, Kosi, Kishangarh, and Pushkar, as well as intermittent periods back and forth into Brindaban or wandering the Braj countryside, punctuated by recurring invasions and conflicts. The Sevak Jas Viradavali and Rasik Parichayavali are taken as his final compositions, both written in 1787, after some years spent exclusively in Brindaban. It is therefore assumed that Brindaban Das died sometime thereafter, at almost 90 years of age. His works contribute to the Radhavallabh Sampradaya's Vani, a sung textual corpus that serves as the arena for the divine encounter in life and worship. As such, his texts cannot be taken as chronicles or political works, or extracted from their religious hinterland. O'Hanlon and Washbrook outline the tension between religious texts and historiography in South Asia. Quote, "For the faithful, religion represents a transcendental system of meaning, rising above the mutable circumstances of place and time. Yet social and political relationships necessarily take place within particular contexts, to which historians necessarily give emphasis." End quote. The Harikala Baili is unlike other works in Brindaban Das's repertoire, and does not follow what might be described as a conventional bhakti strategy. Here, expectations developed from social and political relationships are deeply entwined with theological worldviews and a profound meditation on suffering. This is apparent from Brindaban Das's grounding his discussion in recent Mughal history, rather than mythological landscapes. He does not attempt to mythologize his experience, projecting Krishna into a timeless realm governed by Puranic protocols. Instead, the Harikala Baili presents a case against the deity, drawing on timeless epic material as a body of evidence for a contemporary plea, in view of a recent tragedy. Thus, Brindaban Das takes the received tradition of Krishna as a manipulating and betraying personality, and redacts this understanding according to prevalent social codes regarding the expectations and obligations between an overlord and his tenants. In effect, this translates the relationship between a god and his devotee into a social contract. This contract itself is coloured by the immediate past, the draining of authority from these ties, and most significantly, the failure of figures in authority to protect those in their service. Here then, Krishna is the supreme authority who has forsaken the urgent needs of Braj, his contracted territory. This striking dialogue with God takes an innovative form, which is more nuanced than those alternative strategies that championed political leaders or sought to alienate the other as constructed through religious categories. That Brindaban Das did not follow these strategies, although he was in need of political protection in the fallout from 1757 and had seen his world ravaged by an alien army, raises many questions. On one level, this text gestures to a more complicated history of patronage and the variegated context behind the composition of works. At the same time, the example of Brindaban Das suggests that deities need to be taken seriously as agents in South Asian historiography and as legitimate patrons and lords in a social capacity. It certainly appears in this text that despite Krishna's behaviour, the dead devotees resolutely maintained their side of the contract, and Brindaban Das intended to continue with his.
Thank you. First of all, wonderful texts you found. They're really fascinating. Interesting, all kinds of ways. I'll open up to questions. I'm going to take my privilege as the presenter of the series to ask a first question, because I think they're so fascinating. I can't keep my mouth shut. You've shown really well how this classic hymnal structure in poetry is being used in a really strikingly different social context, historical context, and with a new angle on many of the classic ways of sort of talking about Krishna and complaining about Krishna And you've talked a lot, really interestingly, about the context, the patronage context, the way people are thinking about power at that time that is shaping how they're making those kinds of complaints. And I suppose I just have a small question, which is about, as well as the change in that tradition, the continuity of it. What's striking to me, as somebody knows the Gita Govinda and the Rupa Goswami hymns, is how incredibly familiar they sound and how extremely similar they are to the voice of the gopi complaining about Krishna, where the gopi as sadhu is repeatedly used. The gopi is the sadhu who's been hurt, she's in pain, she might die. If you look at some of the Goswami texts, it's really a complaint. It's really harsh, and some of the same words, that it's a lot of theological language. Tapas is the way he talks about this torture is actually the classic sadhu kind of image. And there's a lot of talk about Radha and her tapas and how in her suffering she's actually a strong sadhu character. And as you say, the bhaktas are climbing up to Krishna in that kind of Radha image, not being given grace as a nice, compassionate patron, as it were. There's that proving yourself a Krishna thing. So I'm just wondering, is there still a sense of the continuity of that tradition in which you complain to Krishna and the depth of your complaint? I mean, really see this in the Hamsa. Hamsa Dutta, you really see this, you know, her, and her as the ascetic sort of withering away there. But the depth of the complaint takes you to the depth of feeling for Krishna in some way. Is there also a continuity in those works as well as a transformation of the tradition?
Well, one area which I think I still need to work on is the kinds of sources he was using. Because as I say, I mean, he's drawing a lot on the Mahabharata here, rather than going to sort of other bhakti canonical works which talk explicitly about the complaint of the gopi. And it's interesting that he didn't frame the whole thing through that voice. I mean, you say, he does it implicitly. But what's interesting about him is, because he's from the Ratavallabh Sampradaya, and they've got sort of two key features in terms of its text. One, like I say, they're very particular that they only talk about the relationship between Krishna and Radha. So even with the Bhagavata Purana, they celebrate it as a text, but all of the things about his childhood and the fact that he doesn't even mention Radha, they bracket all of that out. So they're not interested in any other narrative episodes. And so even when he leaves Vrindavan, that doesn't happen according to the Ratavallabh Sampradaya. He continues to stay in this eternal form with Radha, which has bearing on the second aspect, which is theoretically, according to this sect, there's no such thing as Varaha, because Krishna never leaves Radha, and Krishna doesn't have any other loves among the gopis. They are just there to be her handmaidens, which is interesting, because it means that in theory there would never have been the complaint of the gopi to Krishna in this sect. And so I think in a way a lot more work needs to be done on what's happening with this sect in the 18th century, because a lot of this has been codified over the last couple of centuries, and I think, and it would be interesting to try and pin down exactly which doctrines the Ratavallabh Sampradaya is kind of emphasizing at this point, because you know, obviously Krishna, Vrindavanas is playing with it by looking on these sources outside the standard text associated with the sect. So what else is he reading? And would there have been the fear that if he started talking about Varaha imagery, then it would have looked like he wasn't really part of his sect and was perhaps a more kind of Chaitanyaic follower? Or what's going on there? So it could be that that was part of the reason why he started plugging into the Mahabharata corpus more explicitly, rather than going through the Varaha motions, possibly.
And you've got war there as well. That's interesting. Thank you.
I have two questions. My first one is the same as yours. but just a small comment on that. I mean, one reason why. I mean, to me, it seems like, you know, he's talking about Krishna, and then sort of the two main sources on it are either, you know, Krishna and Vrindavan, which is, you know, the gopi sort of things, that is central in his tradition. Then you have the Mahabharata, which is very military in a sense. And so to me, it sort of seems natural to reach out for that if you're sort of, I mean, it's to talk it in to talk of battle and killing and blood and severed heads and so on, at the same time talk about Krishna meeting the gopis or Krishna leaving the gopis. It's sort of a clash of rasas, literally speaking. And so it seems unlikely that he would sort of combine these two things, whereas it seems more likely than to draw on something that's still related to Krishna, but that suits the mood of the rest of the work better.
Can I just comment on that, sure. actually? Because what's interesting is often when you read literature about the Mahabharata, etc., they kind of factor out the bhakti response to it in a big way. I went to a talk, for example, the other day, and the speaker was talking about betrayal in the Mahabharata, etc. And at the end, I said, was this carried through, etc.? And as far as he knew, if Krishna's going to betray anyone, then you're going to do it in the voice of a gopi. And so it is interesting that people are still using the epic material in new, interesting ways. And I think it kind of almost tap into this whole question of what's happening with the Sanskrit versus vernacular, etc. Because here he is, and he's doing quite not innovative things anyway with the Sanskrit corpus, but he's mid 18th century. So
it is an interesting combination. Is your second joke?
It's a question, really. Most of the passages you cited were either before verse 21, if I got it right, or after verse 175. Uh-huh. And I was just wondering what's kind of in the middle.
I don't know. because this took quite a lot of time, because there isn't an edited edition. I prepared the edited edition for all the verses up to sort of, I think, around 30. Mm. And then, so basically I did the beginning and the end. And the middle section still needs a lot of work. So it could be that he comes out with all sorts of exciting things halfway through. But I think my arguments still hold water, because the way I structured it by using the end verses, there is a continuity of voice going through. There is a continuity of argument. I've started now translating more material from the central portions. In particular, I was looking to see if there's more discussion of the political scenes. But on the whole, no, there's just more references to epic material. One of my ongoing projects will be to try and finish it, because how many verses are there altogether? It's sort of 190 verses, I think. And some of them are couplets, some of them are coveters, it's quite a long work. But the good thing is we do have... I was working from three manuscripts, and one of them is complete the whole way through, so it could be done.
But then does that mean that the text is sort of in a contemporary adherence of a tradition? It's not read, or it's sort of not part of their the text that they themselves read and sing or whatever?
No, to be honest. His works are still being sung almost every day in Vrindavan. But he was incredibly prolific. And I have the exact figure of how many. Yeah, so in theory, there are 20,000 strophes of his still available, but he's believed to have composed 100,000 verses. So he's incredibly prolific. And so obviously in the worship context today, they usually go for the more overtly devotional material. They don't really sing this. But
I guess it's quite a specific context for you,
yeah. Yeah, I think this would raise a lot of eyebrows in the congregation.
But with certain poets, it seems strange where certain poets, like, for example, Suldas, people talk about, for example, before he becomes associated, with the Vallabha Sampradaya, a lot of his works, is a bit more... He can say a few more things, and he's a bit more... He's allowed to say a few more critical things. But then once he becomes part of the Vallabha Sampradaya proper with the manuscripts, then they kind of adhere to their doctrine a bit more. Uh-huh. And it seems surprising that he's allowed to from what he does within his poetry, in terms of criticise so much, and then people who would have had this later don't change anything or edit anything out.
And I think it must be because he's just produced so much that they just kind of... left it to the side and said, well, we'll just let that one go there. Because after this, I've translated a couple of his other works, and after this he continues with devotional output.
But with Surdas, for example, they say that this was because he hadn't met Vallabha then. This, nothing like that happens here. Is it because he hadn't met the head of the Radha?
I haven't found a tradition about why he's doing it.
I think that what you said at the beginning, that he participated in that horrific event, right? And he knew it, he put it in his belly, and at the same time, his associates knew it too. And so that he produced his complaint or his, the whole bhakti thing was that they characterize bhakti as sharing one-to-one. Quite different from the older semantic of bhakti. The bhakti semantic from the middle age or early modern age came to that God and me, we are in a world, and I am, we are talking. That's very nicely put by Friedel Hardy in his book, Buddha Bhakti. That's the idea, that participating one-to-one, and there this sort of complaint comes, and this sort of ethno social religion comes, of course. The other side, what happened at that time, Mughal was crumbling, but they have their military system with Mamluks, etc. And the concept of Mamluks, they used to used to be the loyal follower of the king, and king will look after everything. They are also called ghulams, but that was slightly different from the idea of slaves. They were ghulams, they were doing everything for and the god or king was doing everything for them. And and that later came the idea, the concept of chela, which was taken by the sons very much. That's also from a combination of Afghan, Middle Asia, etc. words. The chelas were very much in the Afghan place, like Farrukhabad and other places. There, the kingship was based, their power was based on the army, who are really made of chelas. You can say slave, or you can say very close relationship. They were not getting any particular salary, they were not mercenary, but they were completely loyal to their master, with the idea that master will completely protect them by all means and everywhere. So that is what you were talking about, and that was coming out. That why didn't you keep up your part of the contract? We have our contract. That's the old idea of the South Indian bhakti, that I am your bond servant, was slightly different from this idea of this chela, mamluk, or ghulam, whatever you call them. And that was a different sort of, both are often translated as slave, but it was not slave, the Muslim, Middle East, Afghan sense. And that was the thing that he was talking, isn't it? From your, he was talking that, that you haven't kept your part of the contract. And it is you, me, the idea is you and me. I am not talking about the world, what you are deceiving or not deceiving. Forget about it. But I am your slave, but not born slave. And so I am your slave, and the contract is you will protect me.
Exactly.
And you didn't do it.
Do you find, I mean, is there that distinction?
Is that, I don't know.
No, I think that's really, really right. And I mean, particularly when, before this, he'd been living in Vrindavan for 20 years, and he was living in the house of a guru, he was living in a temple, and so here the figure with the large halo is his guru. And I think it, he did, well, he says in the poem, you know, we are part of your household, and
yes,
there is this
exactly.
expectation.
That's the,
So no, I think that's what's going on. But of course, after this, he doesn't mention his guru's death in this, at least in the bits I've translated. But he does talk about the members of the guru's family, etc. And he's, the poet himself is popularly called Chacha, because he's remembered as kind of this uncle figure in the community, and he was and that's because he was thought of almost as the spiritual brother of one of the later gurus. And he was there for 90 years in this community. Well, his lifetime was 90 years, so he was there for a long time within the community, at a point when their leaders were being killed, their leading devotees were slain. They couldn't stay in Vrindavan. And I think that's the whole point. I think this is really taking issue... Well, not taking issue, but it's taking issue with the role of Krishna as the Lord of Braj. And it's not just saying that in a metaphorical sort of, you know, Lord of the world, oh, he's Lord of Braj. He really is the Lord of Braj, and he has a responsibility to it. So yeah, I think it is this, yeah, this shift between bhakti and the social role of the slave. Well, not slave, but...
Can I make a small comment? I'm just thinking, what you're saying is really helpful in so many ways, and it makes me want to query this notion of the religion as the transcendental timeless that's often used by historians to characterise religion. I think it's a bit naive sometimes in looking at what religious experience consists of for these sorts of characters. Religion is transcendent, and then history, which is an actual engaged real experience. Whereas it seems to me... what's nice about this is that it's both completely, very subversive towards Krishna, and at the same time it completely fits the idea that he's still in this relationship with Krishna, so deeply and closely in the presence of Krishna throughout this experience, that for him all of it is Krishna's fault, and he gets to shout at him and rail at him. It's very Job-like, actually, as a text. It's quite fascinating. And that maybe it's not that... You know, Krishna as a principle of justice, he is criticizing. Krishna as a presence who he can query and shout at and complain about, but still say, oh, your beloved such and such, is a kind of a continuous strand that is, in a way, shows that he's both within religion as an experience and outside of it as a transcendental indicator of justice, as it were. It's kind of an interesting dual thing, in a way.
And particularly with this sect, there is this whole question about the two Vrindavans. And on the one hand, Krishna and Radha are still dancing together. He never left, etc. On the other hand, there is the tradition that he did leave. There is the tradition that he imparted a lower self, which went off. And so I think... It is this this whole question about, as a devotee, on the one hand, yes, you're living in this temple, Krishna isn't next door, but he is next door. And so there is this idea that when Vrindavan Das and the devotees of the sect went out wandering, they were in the exact grove where Radha and Krishna still were. But that adds the extra dimension of what happens when you can't be in Vrindavan anymore, when all of your devotion is tied to being there, etc. And it's the same kind of issues that other sects, like the Vallabhacharya sect, had when they had to suddenly take all of the Murtis out of Vrindavan and set up in all of these other courts, etc. And so I think in other areas of my thesis, I talk about the relationship between Vrindavan as place and the devotee who can't be there anymore, and what kinds of imagery they'd be using in order to contact those sacred spaces. And I actually think that music rose to the fore in this sect because it was a way of creating the Vrindavan space when you weren't even there anymore. And I mean, you see here in this portrait of him, he's there in the musical gathering, which in this sect is called Samajgan, and they do it every evening. And it's there in other bhakti sects in Vrindavan, but for this sect it's such an important thing. And I think a lot of it does draw back to this historical period when you couldn't rely on being there yourself. So
it does relate a lot to, I guess we can relate it to older texts, but just generally, obviously this devotee would have been a normal person too. So it's like, when you deal with stress or post-traumatic stress after a war or an event where you see something horrific, I'm thinking of something like Elie Wiesel's work, and after the, you know, when the Holocaust or whatever happens with the Jewish situation, and then just how you write and what you, the things that you question.
Mm.
I mean, some of the things that he picks from that I see, because normally a lot of these podcasts, they have such a systematic thing that they stick to. They're very rare. Often they don't stray from their sampradaya or the topics that their sampradaya deals with. And so for him to bring in themes like Mahabharata, and it almost seems that, you know, when you're questioning everything and your beliefs, and that's the only thing he can relate to, I guess.
Yeah.
So like,
yeah. No, exactly. And I mean, one of the bits in there, he talks about Krishna fleeing to the water, and that's the idea of when Krishna, you know, runs off to Dwarka and he hides, and because Dwarka is an island, it's you hid in the water. And there's this whole tradition about Krishna going to Dwarka and massacring his family, and Vrindavan Das doesn't really talk about it that much, which is interesting. And I think part of the reason is when Wendy Doniger did a long section on this exact tradition in Mahabharata and the Puranas, and there's all of this apparatus to explain it, and it does go into the usual protocols of, oh, it happened because there was the sage who was angry with his children, and so Krishna had to, etc., etc. And Vrindavan Das doesn't do any of that, and so it is as though he's saying, this is what my traditions tell me, but actually none of this is going to emotionally satisfy me. And so instead he just does this long outburst instead.
Very bhakti, isn't it? In so many ways.
You think that there was a sort of also any input from the sister ideas going around at that time with the sons and all these people? Was there any... Radha Vallabhi didn't go up into a sort of compartment, isolated.
No, I don't think so. I think, well, it's an interesting period, the 18th century, because just at the same time, obviously, you have the court in Jaipur saying, right, let's try and systematize the sampradayas and come up with a nice, clear doctrine on what bhakti Vaishnavism is. And in fact, the Radha Vallabhis don't really fit into that system. So, I mean, one of my ongoing projects will try and look at what they compromised and what they didn't compromise and how they got around it. And I actually think quite a lot of interesting stuff happened in that period as they were adapting
Monica
to it.
Oh, yes, Monica has worked a lot on that, yes.
Yeah, and I think particularly because they're a small sect, and so if you're a big one and you have the powerful Murtis with you, etc., and you can say, I will, you know, raise up your status as a king, then obviously the nice template of what Vaishnavism should look like will fit closer to what you're already bringing to the table. Whereas the Radha Vallabhis are small, they don't have much political power, so in the way they had the most, they had to cut out, etc., from their idiosyncrasy. So I think that could be really interesting. But at the same time, in this text, with the devotees at the end who he lists, they're not all Radha Vallabhi. And I think he would have been interacting with the other sects while in Vrindavan. And so I don't think he was necessarily completely closed off at all. And I think that may have been a later process, which for political reasons, they start organizing themselves into categories. Certainly in another poem of his I translated, he talks about devotion to the goddess Radha's feet, which you've obviously heard about. And in that poem, when I presented on it before, he uses an icon of the soles of Radha's feet, which have 19 symbols decorating them. And it's not really that prevalent in Radha Vallabhi imagery today, but I did find an image of this icon from the Gaudiads. So, obviously, there was an awful lot of interaction going on there, which has sort of been ironed out and the creases have been removed, etc. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more in his corpus, which could tell us a lot.
It's
so,
interesting.
One other thing, I look mostly at Tulsidas.
Oh.
And so, but there's very rarely anything clear-cut that was very... this is history. So when did this, like, I guess what we... Because a lot of often people will say, well, India doesn't really do history or didn't do history. But then when did this clearly, you know, okay, this is clearly historical, bringing that into the corpus? I mean, that, with Tulsidas, the only things that you can lock down is, okay, some of these words he used are clearly of Persian origin. That's why it's... that's how we can establish it.
Yeah.
But when this... some of the couplets here, they clearly established, you know, it's history.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, he names dates. He literally says there were two invasions of Braj, one in 1813, one in 1817, which are Vikrama years. And so you can identify all of this. And the reason we can sketch out an outline of his life is because he does leave his chronograms with his dates of the poems. And he says, you know, at the moment I'm writing in Bharatpur, but before I was in Farrukhabad. And so you can actually do an awful lot. So it could be that... Well, I mean, Alison Bush obviously has done quite a lot on the kind of development of a historical genre in Braj, and clearly there are a lot of works which are starting to use kind of the chronicle form, but as I was saying in this paper, they are often reliant on tropes which you get in other kinds of genre. And so so for example, in the text I talked about by Keshav Das, he is describing a battlefield. He's completely rewritten the results of the battle, but he is describing that it happened, and he's putting all these different forces together which historically weren't quite there, but he's there to present a key historical message relating to the current politics and the current patronage systems. Whereas here Brindavan Das is talking about something that only happened a couple of years ago, and he's not doing it for a patron. He's not trying to set up a new political system, but at the same time I think the fact that he does date his works and he starts being more conscious of time rather than kind of earlier, well, still almost concurrent Sanskrit works, which is like, you know, the scholars in Benares who are desperately trying to remove his historicity from their traditions in order to give it authority. I think the fact he's not doing that ties into the fact that he's what Sheldon Pollock would call a kind of detti or free intellectual. And so he puts in place and time, I think, in order to kind of pinpoint his patrons and his protection. And I think because none of that was guaranteed in this period, by flagging up the fact you're in Farrukhabad, suddenly Farrukhabad becomes a place in literature. And by saying you're in Bharatpur, where the king is Sujam Singh, suddenly Sujam Singh becomes a patron of intellectual arts, etc. So I think that would have had taken its toll on literature and the development of history. But, I mean, there are so many reasons why, in this period, history was suddenly moving this way.
Not less the long contact with the Islamic tradition.
We
like to categorize, categorically date a thing and place, have mentioned the place. So there have been a lot of that side by side. They really lived side by side, but not isolated company. The Hindus or the Radhavallabhis lived here and there. So they lived together. And I don't rule out a deep influence of post or actually Mughal period influence of Islamic way of doing things, political, social, whatever it is, and especially also the Afghans in between Babur and Rukmayun, Sher Shah and that period, and they were also very much neither Shia nor Sunni, they were really, really Sufis. And in that way, they got a bit sort of rapport with ordinary people. Because they, at that period, and even today, lots of Hindus in Allahabad and also go to the Dargahs if there is a problem. They were not away. The sort of Sufi dargahs were so common and so popular. I grew up in Bihar, near Buxar, when all these things were happened. And yeah, the drop of the hat, you go to the local dargah, Pir's dargah, and you ask your things from him, because he is there and he will. That was an impersonal influence that came, and it was quite, I remember from my childhood in Bihar, it was like that. It was very much sort of interdependence on religious belief.
Is there any Sufi, can you see any Sufi links?
Well, I was just wondering actually whether implicitly there is the connection through hagiographies, because I think hagiography was a massive force behind the development of historical genres. And so in the Radhavallabh Sampradaya, for example, the big text on hagiography. It was by Bhagwan Mubit, who set up, you know, a whole series of different images of all of the key devotees in the history of the sect. And obviously, it's at this point that you start having references to kings, etc., coming into the lives of these saints. And obviously with Sufism, which is so... which underlines the role of these lines of transmission, the lines of the Sufis, and the fact that the Sufis were always there with a political patron, etc., and the patrons were always building the dargahs, etc. It could be that that style of writing kind of shifted across from Sufism into here. It could be. I mean, and even the idea of the musical assembly, of course, the idea of approaching God through the music.
That all reminded me. It's a very, very sophisticated, you can just put it in Persian.
Yeah.
Manuscript. And like that. But I have a deep conviction that Sufism went in and somehow nobody ever tried or dared, in context of Hindutva, to mention it. But
I was just going to say, we're publishing Mughal Bhakti. There was a panel at the AAR last year. It's all on Mughal Bhakti, exactly. And we're publishing it in the Journal of Hindu Studies.
Oh, brilliant.
Because it is very difficult. Nobody wanted to talk about it. But long ago, I wrote that the sort of goddess bhakti in modern languages. There was this Guru Gobind's work on Bhagavati Yu. Now, Bhagavati is there, nothing but a war goddess trampling the Mughals and nobody else. that was the Guru Gobind's time. It was very important because Mughals were trampling the Sikhs and other Hindus.
It's quite helpful if you've got a bunch of gods you can call upon to deal with historical events. I mean, this would be really helpful.
And it is now accepted in Guru Granth. It is there. And you cannot say that it is not there. It is there. So time and circumstances and I feel that it is absolutely inevitable that it will somehow influence you. You cannot blind yourself, and unless you are in a village where only Brahmins resides.
A big fence. Oh, let us go soon. Coming to the end of our time, can I ask one more theological question, which is just this. In some ways, putting it within a Krishna Radha Viraha context helps to defend Krishna because he hurts you, but it's okay because that's bhakti. And putting it in a Mahabharata context seems to help to defend Krishna because the whole point of Krishna's appearance is, you know, if anything bothers you, forget about it. You're the soul, nothing, you know, none of this is real. Go be Arjuna. The only thing that doesn't fit with those two theodicy readings, those defenses, is the Karuna concept, the notion of compassion and justice. And is there, I don't know the Radhavallabha theology very well, is there a strong sense of Krishna as just and compassionate and kind? Because not all Krishnas have a lot of justice or compassion. Often he's quite tough.
Yeah. Well, in this text it talks about him being the source of compassion and tender to his devotees. But I'm wondering how sectarian that actually is and how much it's just, you know, this is what people say about Krishna, you're meant to be compassionate, so be compassionate. Because it really, for the sect, the main emphasis is on how, really it's Sringada Rasa and that's it.
Yeah.
And the whole emphasis is on this connection between Radha, who's really raised up as the supreme, and Krishna is there adoring her. And that's the real thing. And so, if anything, it'd be Radha's compassion coming down to Krishna. It is interesting that Radha's not mentioned in this poem. And I talked about that in my thesis, and I'm going to try and draw this out in other works, because I think, essentially, at this period, in this period, she is sort of... she is a source of compassion, etc., and you are trying... soteriologically, you are trying to access the divine couple in that moment of tender Shringara Rasa. But she is just so supreme and so transcendent that she won't touch the human sphere at all. So if something goes wrong, then you go talk to Krishna, because he's still, he's actually being lowered down to the status of mediator in this. And so he's the one whose hands are dirty when things go wrong in Vrindavan. But she is just on super Vrindavan level at the moment, so you don't really talk to her when something goes awry. Mm. I mean, that's my theory.
Thank you so much. Innovative in so many ways, and really fruitful. What a really lovely text to have come across. And thank you very, very much. I'm looking forward to reading through it more.
Thank you.